So today is July 10th, 1984, and this is Lamont and Marion and Brooke Wentz, and the time is 1:06:26 p.m. We're at 6 Harrison Street. Most of the things that I perform live have become such big productions that it's very hard to get places that can afford to do it. And I have intentionally tried not to just come up with something that fits in the plaster cast mold of this one night stand type of thing where you go in and like Phil Glass used to tell me how proud he was of the fact that he could set it up in 2 hours, it sounded good every time, and he could get in and get out of the concert in the same night. I realized the practicality of that, and it's not that I just really don't want to do it, but the way I compose and the way I work, I have always followed my intuition and my inspiration. And I am totally involved with the well-tuned piano at that time. I'm also composing some new works. I have something that will first go through a computer stage. We have a new synthesizer made by David Rayner, and this synthesizer is good for me because it can work in ratios so that I can continue my work in just intonation and come up with intervals that really nobody has had a chance to hear before. Bob Bilecki, whom I work with, has also built for me some custom-made devices that are capable of dialing up intervals of that sort. So the reason I don't do a whole bunch of performances every year, unless I do one of my big productions, stems from this fact that they are so costly. And for instance, we have done the well-tuned piano 3 times here at DIA since we've been in this building. I did it many series in the past. When I do the well-tuned piano, it usually consists of 7 or 8 concerts. Each concert is about a week apart because did you hear some of the well-tuned piano? What did you hear in the last concert?
In October of 81.
Mm-hmm. Probably you heard the 5-hour part of the 5-hour concert.
Yeah, it was a
5-hour,
yeah.
Right.
You had done them live and recorded.
You see, to do this, I rehearse and we tune the piano for a month or two before the concerts begin, and then I'm performing once a week. So I like to do at least 7 or 8 concerts so that people can see the growth and development of the piece. Each concert is somewhat different, even though the chord changes, let's say, are the same, even though the thematic material is pretty much the same. I then take this, begin at some place with the opening chord, and it develops and grows, and each performance takes its own shape and structure. I might spend 2 hours in the pool at one performance and only an hour at another performance and more time in the romantic chord, so that it becomes quite an organically alive thing, this performance series. And if I perform on Sundays, I have a tape playback on Wednesdays so that people who want to come and hear the performance again can, and also I get then a chance to hear it and think about what I've done, and it influences my next performance. So in years where I do the well-tuned piano somewhere, I do about 8 performances wherever I do one of these big productions. We right now have an invitation to do something in Stuttgart in 85.
I really don't think that John Cage needs any introduction. However, I am going to give you a little lowdown, I guess one should say. And I'll tell you a little bit about the piece called Roratorio, which is an Irish circus on Finnegan's Wake. It is a radio play called Roratorio, an Irish circus on Finnegan's Wake, was awarded the Carl Shuka Prize.
Right.
Is that right? Shuka Prize. For the best composition for 1979, it was felt to represent a convincing example of radio poetry that at the same time pushed forward the frontiers of the medium. It was also presented at the Donaueschingen Musical Festival, and on making the award, the jury said, Cage opens up an endlessly rich acoustic world, although it is strongly rooted in literary and musical ideas. It is a world made up of sounds, text, and music, one which the listener is able at will to experience and at the same time is exposed to sounds, which the radio, normally restricted to the meditation of one-dimensional information, cannot normally offer. I thought that was a good quote to start out, give an explanation of the piece. Now, I know that for a while you've been saying that you've wanted to always see Merce realize it, or when you came up for the festival, the birthday celebration that we did for you, I believe in 82 or 81, it hadn't been realized, I think, at that time by the Cunningham Company. So when did, what year, and how did...
Brooke, I'm not a good historian. But
well, you're better on your own pieces.
Since this was an Irish circus,
uh-huh.
and since Merce Cunningham is half Irish and half Slavic, I mm-hmm. thought it was appropriate that he make a choreography for the work. And finally he did. It's quite a large situation because it involves Irish traditional musicians playing not together, but in circus. Each one plays about 20 minutes of solos, spaced wherever he wishes in the hour of the composition.
Oh, Brooke, my tape recorder's also sick. It's only going out of one channel.
You wanted to use mine?
Do you have one that's like this? Well, that's all right.
It's
I mean,
a bit bigger.
It's a little big. That's right. Yours has the two little
Sony.
Things on the side.
It's Sony.
Just as long as I can pick, and I know that you knew Yoko a long time ago from here in the 60s, or actually probably before that. I don't know when you knew. Yeah, you probably met Yoko here when she went out with Toshi, when she was married.
She was still married to Toshi.
Yeah. So.
And I was at Wesleyan University in the Center for Advanced Studies.
Right.
Yoko and Toshi would come up and visit me. And Yoko, you know, had this kind of. Concert giving place. Where things by Lamont Young and Henry Flint and so forth were done.
Uh-huh.
Pieces like Draw a Straight Line, you know.
Follow it.
You've heard it. You know all of it. It was conceptual art, so to speak, to begin.
The fluxes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Right.
And Yoko it was quite marvelous. You'd climb all these stairs and then you'd see Yoko sitting at the table ready to take the money for the tickets. And she was so elegant looking with that straight black hair.
And this is when she was married with Toshi.
Yes.
So did she participate? Yes, she did. She wrote her own pieces.
Yes.
Those short
but
ones.
Mostly she was like the one who presented all this
uh-huh.
music. And I think it was like once a week, wasn't it?
It
was frequent.
Was it?
And it was very much, it excited a great deal of interest.
Uh-huh.
Not among a huge audience, but a very select audience. And people would come from great distances to go to one of those concerts.
So it was open to the public, too?
Oh, right.
I got more of an idea that, at least from Lamont,
Invitational?
Not that it was invitational, but it was mostly friends coming over.
It was. But there were people who were not friends who also came, who were really interested in experimental music or what you call avant-garde.
Yeah.
I think it was marvelous.
What did you think about meeting someone, let's say like Ryan Eno, when you did that musician article? Have you ever heard his music, or do you?
I'd heard a record.
Which record?
But when the one about the airport.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Music from airport.
It has it's characterized by a kind of music that recurs after separated by silences.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true?
That's right.
And the funny thing is that the same music comes back after each silence, or more or less the same.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
His work probably, I know very little about it, but
yeah.
His work probably uses, takes a good advantage of changes in technology.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of music today does.
Particularly, I think the greatest one in that connection, or the most brilliant, giving indications of magic and so forth,
yeah.
is Laurie Anderson.
Yeah.
Don't you think
oh,
so?
Oh, yeah. Well, she uses wonderful text, too.
Yes, and she's so full of surprises.
Yeah.
And it's like you pull ducks
are birds out of hats and out of the air, you know,
yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah. Now, remember when I took you out, though, a long time ago, and we went to go to roulette, and you heard this man named Fred Frith, because he was playing with Joel and the Antla.
Yeah.
And remember, he was very interested in improvisation. What do you think of improvisation, like that type of music? A lot of people here in New York, like John Zorn, are doing improvisation.
I'm much more interested in improvisation than I was years ago.
Uh-huh.
I used to have a chip on my shoulder against improvisation. And the reason I had it was because so many people who improvise the same way each time they improvise, because it's based on their taste and on their memory.
Wow.
I've developed various ways now of improvising, not myself,
right.
but of getting other people to improvise that separates them from that taste and memory deal.
Uh-huh.
I like, you know that I like things that are beyond our control. And I like those shells that I put water in, and when we tip them, they gurgle. But they don't gurgle when you want them to, they gurgle when they want them.
That's beyond your control.
Uh-huh.
Hi, everybody. Wow. How's my hair? My name is David Weinstein. I'm the director of special projects for Roulette, and this is indeed a special project, very unusual for us. There is so much information floating through this room, and of course through the book tonight. I don't know how we're ever going to untangle it. I'm going to try to sort of MC the proceedings for you as we go along. There are some unbelievable people here, and there are many who I asked to come. I asked every of the 80 people in the book to come tonight. And there's some dead ones, but there's some lazy ones, and there's a bunch of people that are traveling and couldn't come. So, like, Phil Niblock is getting off a plane right now. The most important thing for me to do at this very moment, since you kind of know where you are and what's going on, is to introduce Brooke Wentz. Please welcome Brooke Wentz.
Thank you, David. Thank you. it's so wild. You have to realize that those tapes that you heard, I was like 22, 23, 21 years old. So I was very young. But it is fun to hear that. David's amazing for putting this together. This book, I'll just speak a little bit about how it came about. I was a radio host for a long time, and a lot of the things that we did when we interviewed people at WKCR, we did it on Reel to Reel. And then if we interviewed someone off campus, we would have to tape it and then transfer it to Reel to Reel and then actually cut it up. And actually, my friend Andy Kaplow had to take me once to the emergency room because I cut my finger. I stuck my hand in like the Reel to Reel I was spinning, which was stupid. But anyway, we would cut it up and then we would play it with the music. Eventually, though, a lot of the interviews and whatnot that I did, I ended up taping on cassette. So during COVID, actually, I was in my basement. I've carried around the reel-to-reels for a long time, but I also had a bunch of cassettes, and I'm like, I can't just have them sit here and wilt. This has been like 20, 30 years later. I have to do something. So I got them digitally transcribed or digitally copied, and then I found a transcription person who transcribed them. And I thought, well, I'll just put together a compendium for my daughter so she knows all the crazy people I used to know. And so I found somebody to transcribe them, and then it was too much work for me to go through and edit them, so I went to another colleague, Julie Grau, who's now has her own publishing company, and she also worked at WKCR when we were there, and I said, do you have any editors I can, like, pay to like help me put this together. And so she turned me on to Lee Smith, who is unfortunately not here. But I was a huge fan of a book that he worked on called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. And so I brought him and asked, and he also worked at Rolling Stone, so he had a lot of comprehension about music journalism. And so I asked him to kindly, edit these interviews or see if they were worthy of doing anything with. And so he did. And, he found them really fascinating. And he's like, Brooke, the 80s are kind of hip now. Like, it's kind of a cool thing. Like, a lot of young people want to know about this era. And I'm like, really? They do? And so we put it together and we sent it out. And Columbia University picked up on it immediately. Of course, not only was I an undergrad there, but also a graduate student. But not only that, is that I really... when I was there, I was really fascinated by the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center, and I think just because I was always sort of an explorer of new music, I do play and I do know how to read music, but I'm not a musician. I just love turning people on to new music, that sort of association, not only in being a graduate from the school, but also a lot of the composers that are in the book also went to school there. But that doesn't mean it's a school book. It's actually meant to be sort of a cultural statement. And what was also really fascinating when I started putting these all together is that so many people intermix. Like, the word John Zorn, Elliot Sharp, and Christian Marclay have probably come up more than any other ones. Maybe John Cage, too, or Lamont. Like, it's like they're all interspersed with all these other people, and so it's sort of becoming this kind of mix of overlay with everyone in that scene at the time. And it was a scene in the sense that, as you can tell, like, a lot of the experimental jazz musicians were also playing with the improvisers, and the improvisers were playing, some were stretching bounds and playing with some of the more pop people. And so it was a really fluid city at that time. And it was very exciting. I mean, I'm not to say that New York is not exciting now, but it was just a very different time, and things were in a different place. What else can I say about the book? So we put it together, and I just, we picked the interviews. I have to say, are only of the interviews that I actually have on cassette or had actual physical interview with. A lot of people like Elliot or like Elliot Sharp or Christian Marclay, I have interviewed numerous times, but I didn't have an audio tape of theirs. So, that's why we interspersed it with other comments from other people around who were very, present in my life at that time. Roulette was a great space I used to go to all the time. They were so kind, they always gave me passes to come to free shows, as well as the Kitchen and Experimental Intermedia Foundation, and sometimes at Limelight or whatever. So it really was an interesting time. I don't know what else to really tell you about myself. What else can I say? I'm just an audiophile, I'd say. My dad used to have a reel-to-reel tape, and so I grew up with reel-to-reel tapes. And I learned about the recorded voice, and I've always enjoyed the recorded voice. I've always enjoyed sort of historic listening. And actually, one of the more fascinating things I should mention here, that there are excerpts of about 25 of the interviews available to listen to for free on SoundCloud. And it's really interesting to the 20-year-olds and the 30-year-olds who are in school, and they love hearing these composers talk, especially the ones past or even present. Like, I was in a car once with a young kid, and he was fascinated by Lamont's voice and hearing about him talk about stuff. And so I think it's really awesome to be able to preserve this for other people to understand and to listen. And you do have to realize, we did keep the book, that it was like the photographs are from the time, the excerpts are from the time, even the bios. I don't need to tell you Phil Glass's entire friggin' bio. It's like, that's way too, you can go on Wikipedia and find it. We're talking about what happened at that time, during that time, at that place, in that point of time. And so that's what this book is. It's really a snapshot of this decade.
Okay.
Now, we're going to be joined by our distinguished panel, and we're going to have a little conversation. So I would like to welcome to the stage, please, Gaylord Fields, who's a writer, a journalist, an editor, and a longtime DJ presence on WFMU Freeform Radio. Yay, WFMU. Come in and have a seat. We also have Alana Heiss, who is a producer, a curator, the founder of PS1 and the Clock Tower Gallery, who is here coming up on the stage right now. And then one of my most favorite people in the world, Mary Griffin, who ran the kitchen from like 78 to 84, 85. You will recognize her, but maybe you remember the name Mary MacArthur, which I will not say again. Please welcome to the stage, Mary Griffin. So everybody has something to say, you can imagine. I mean, woo. I'm going to say something very quickly, and then I'm going to hand the microphone back to Brooke and let them run with it. To me, the 80s, there was many, many things happening, and I was here, and I was running roulette at the time with Jim Staley, and yeah, there was the hip-hop scene coming down from the Bronx, there was the loft jazz scene, there was the alternative space scene, there was the, you know, there were the little clubs and the big clubs, but the thing that really changed for me that impacts like roulette and pretty much this community was the crack or the gray area between uptown, downtown, high art, low art. And so, you know, you people probably remember this, but there was a time when you couldn't do serious performances, serious music in a room that had cocktail service or a bar or was an informal setting. It was like you needed the plush seat auditorium, that was the goal, Lincoln Center was the goal, and everybody downtown was like playing in dirty lofts, and therefore it was dirty music or something. The uptown people, in general, were dismissive or even ignorant of the work that was going on downtown. The downtown people were completely aware of what was going on uptown and consumed it and processed it and made something new out of it. That's my take. And now I'm going to hand it over to the panel. Each of them are going to have a little something to say, and then we'll get complicated. You don't have to do it. We'll start with Gaylord.
Oh, I guess I have to do it then. Thanks. Thank you. Well, when I think about the classic hero's journey to downtown, the thing I think about is someone in a cornfield in Iowa or just out of Oberlin finding the big city, finding downtown as that flypaper, and having all these big dreams. That's not my story. I am actually a native of Manhattan, and I had to do the thing where I had to leave my little provincial version of New York, where the boundaries were 93rd Street, 106th Street, Central Park West, Riverside Drive. That was my world until I was 14, and I went to high school in the Bronx. And now the New York educational system, not the best, but I did go to Bronx Science, yes. But they did have one big contribution to culture, and that was a free subway pass. What that meant was a high school student could just ride the subways wherever they want. Suddenly, no boundaries. And it led me downtown. And I liked what I found downtown. I liked just the excitement of it. I knew that when it was time to apply for colleges, NYU was the one because it was downtown. And I found my people there. And then they found more people for me. And I met the people from Iowa and Oberlin. And we all influenced one another. And it was just a wonderful experience just finding out about new music.
And the thing about new music and the kinds of people who are into it, there seem to be two general groups. One is, I'm going to call the cool hunter. And they're just looking for the new thing to push out the old thing. And then there's someone more like the people I knew, and they were sort of the musical magpies. We were the ones who would just sort of build our musical nest out of every shiny thing we could find and figure out how they would sort of mosaic together. And that's what I really liked about specifically the New York City downtown experimental avant-garde scene circa 1980. And I applied those things to my WFMU show, where I found no problem with following Jan and Dean with Lois Vierk, a thing I literally did on a show, and I was surprised to see. So it's really just, I don't know, I'm done. That was 5 minutes, right? So, I don't, please.
You know you can talk for another hour.
No, I can.
We have performers that are going to come on instead of us, so we've got to get off. I'm the person from Iowa that he's talking about, actually, in South Dakota and Kentucky and small towns in southern Illinois. But music was a way out for my family, and they were all mostly string players. They were all classical. And it was, you know, you think back about it, being raised in that environment, you know, just it's a lot of hard work. It's 3-4 hours a day. If you have two instruments, more, and you know you've got to get out and you've got to get a scholarship, and that's how it works. My uncle finally went to Juilliard and ran the composition department for a long time, and we came from Iowa. But most of my relatives were string players and orchestras, and they were relaxed. They were sort of like second-raters and second-rate orchestras all over. I myself have done time in St. Louis Symphony, Chicago Symphony. Finally got to college, got to conservatory, did all that. But I knew I wasn't as good as anybody else, and what I did find out and what made an entrance for me into another wonderful world that made my life was that I actually became a very valuable accompanist. I'm a terrific sight reader, I'm a speed reader anyway. I used to make money going into those Carnegie Institute things saying, if you put $100, if you can read this book in 10 minutes, I can do that. And I used to be able to sight read almost anything, and I could go into a company. I did it with choirs my whole life, you know, on for money. And what that turned into eventually, after getting out into the world and moving to England in the late 60s and finding out about rock and roll, Chuck Berry was a neighbor of mine in St. Louis, so you see, I already knew about that. But finding out about the new kind of rock and roll was really exciting. It took me out of the whole classical thing, and I was with visual artists, which became my world and my life. But of course, music is right always there, especially if you play as many instruments as everybody in this room, you know that it's always ticking away. You know, you're knocking your fork against the plate or whatever you're doing. And I realized that as an organizer of events and producer of things that can connect motifs through this or that, seeing things as you see them through reading an orchestra score, you can really put together exhibitions in a very good way, in a very humble way, because you're not an... And here, of course, I'm not, just stop ranting for a minute. You're not an art academic making an exhibition about a book that you're working on. You're really a viewer who's making an exhibition that you want to work for an audience. And that was always my goal. I had lots of spaces, both in England, came back to New York, started using empty spaces, a lot of them, 5 or 6 or 7. I mean, Phil Glass was related to him. He was my cousin, so you know he would play for me and all the theater people. So I learned about spaces and how it works and how the equipment you have to get and invitations and guards and on and on and on. But back in the back of my mind was all about training as an accompanist, which is that you try to accompany as best you can by giving the right note, but not much more, to the person you're working with, to the artist you're working with. And vaguely, people from my music background started filtering back in, and I would meet people like David Weinstein. We've worked together for 25-30 years. Kate, I was very close to. He knew my secret background, you know. Phil, I had to play that stupid violin part 1,000 times, you know, before he could pay anybody to play those originals. And so those worlds started to integrate, and it was a pleasing thing for me to pick up on all that and be able to have a dialogue with people who I got to know, like Elliot Sharp. John Lurie more difficult, but I did a big show of his, which I'm immensely proud of. And so the combination of my worlds was a very fulfilling one for me, and the ability to transfer back a little bit. Radio was always an interest from the time I was a little girl, because we didn't have television. Of course, it was blah, 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 and had, you know, horses and wagons and all that. I'm joking. I always wanted a radio station, and PS1, when we first got it, the building, I tried to start one, but of course it was not only illegal, but quickly discovered. And then I found out you could have radio vans. And after 20, 30 years at PS1, when we merged with MoMA, I wrote into the document that I could start a radio station, because it's like Harvey Weinstein used to say his goal was to be a manager of a baseball team, and mine was to have a radio station. It was a completely vain thing to do. But there are reasons for it, which I can expound on at great length, but I won't. And I kept it at the clock tower, because I kept the clock tower, all the spaces that had come under my umbrella, because it was so beautiful and so secret. Now, of course, it's so beautiful. $28 million my office sold for as an apartment. Yeah, David, your office was $16 million. Eat that. So anyway, we had those beautiful spaces all around the top of the 13th floor. And when I left PS1 in mid-2011, whatever, I took that radio station, which had been based there, and key people that I love to be with, like David. And we just did whatever we wanted to. We invited whoever we wanted to. They didn't have to make good art or bad art. A lot of them are bands who are just burned out. And they came and they recorded and they talked, and then we did lots and lots and lots of interviews. So the book that we're talking about today is very interesting, very much, that it can be a useful document, because the only reason I was involved with the art world is because it was so much more fun than the music world. We didn't have people weren't practicing so hard. They were just out at nightclubs and, you know, doing coke and everything. In the music world, you know, we were just practicing, and we were dragging our stupid instruments. And I was a classical admirer, we had to tune it every day. It was horrible. But in the art world, you just had to put on skin-tight clothes and big, tall boots and just get out there. So, with radio, you have to find the technicians, but once you walk into that room, it's free. Everything in radio is free, and it's not like mounting an exhibition, which costs $100,000. It's not like trying to produce a series at a concert hall, even a roulette concert hall. It's just free. And that's one of the few things left for the experimental abilities of the great geniuses which plague our lives in New York, all of you, is that we can say, come over to my house. I'll put you on the radio.
Well, a totally different.
Big city?
You know, well, no. The whole thing was an accident, right? I want to talk about the kitchen at that time. I got there in 78. And at that time, it was in a loft on Broome and Worcester Street. Second floor. The rest of the building was co-ops with artists in it. And one of the guys who worked with me said it was a major concert hall on a major truck route. Because if you know, Broome Street is still like that, right? But at that point, the lorries were still going through. Anyway, so I got to the kitchen. Before that, I had run the fellowship program at CAPS, which was like the predecessor of NYFA. Anyway, so I came to the kitchen, and it was a pretty well-established place. No money. Totally illegal. Talking about small downtown spaces, most of them were illegal. I mean, I lived in terror of the fire department because we ran the lighting around the sprinkler system, and you know, all the equipment was scrounged. It was really a hard scrabble. And so the first concert that I was the director of was a John Cage concert, and oh, the place was packed. We could, you know, you could actually squeeze in about 300 people. And I thought, oh, this is great, this is wonderful. And then the next morning, I showed up to work, and, you know, suddenly there wasn't a broom to clean the floor or the beer bottles all over the place. And I sort of got the idea that this was, like, going to be, you know, definitely
a long day,
long tenure. So at that point, it was mainly video and music. And Carlotta Schulman, who's sitting over there, right there, and she was one of the reasons I went there. She was one of the first, if not the first, video curator in the world. And I knew her, and I thought, well, I like Carlotta, I'll go there. So she was running the video program, Reese Chatham was running the music program, and Eric Bogosian was doing publicity. And Jill Crozen was the tech person. So there weren't very many people there, and but it was functional. And what happened was that I think that like 79 and 80 were kind of a cusp for music. In 79, we had the goal to do a week-long festival of new music. Which brought composers from all over the country. Many of them were already running their own venues in Chicago, San Francisco, in all over. And so they came, and we had seven nights of music, five composers each night. The reason it even broke even was that Steve Reich, Phil Glass, Pauline Oliveros, Meredith, and Laurie, I think, did an opening benefit for it. And it was done in collaboration with the, what was it called, the American Music Critics Association, which John Rockwell, who was at the Times then, had arranged to focus on what he called post-Cajun music. Anthony Davis wanted to call it post-Ellingtonian music. And what was interesting, I think, in terms of new music was that all these critics came from all over the country, and each day they would discuss the concert that happened the night before and write about it for their papers. So it really kind of spread the news all over the country. It really heightened the idea of a different kind of music over the course. And at the end of that June, it was in June, I think there was like a huge change. The last concert, the last evening, was all was mainly the younger composers, and they were all wearing black, and the decibel range was elevated way up, and I think that was really a big change in what had happened, because before, we were worried about the trucks. Now the neighbors were worried about us. And it became really very difficult. One evening, John Zorn was doing a piece, and somebody had done a sound check at 4 in the morning and woken everybody up. So in the middle of John Zorn's piece, he was blowing bubbles and making huge noise. And suddenly the upstairs neighbor is banging on the ceiling, on the floor with a huge log. And he'd wait until it got quiet, and then he'd bang a bit more. And I'm begging him on the intercom to stop. And John just goes, "Okay, motherfucker." And he just blows the loudest thing you ever heard. So anyway, it was horrible. It was horrible. But it was very fruitful. And somehow or other, I got, I had a really good relationship with the National Endowment for the Arts, and I was on so many panels, but they put me on the opera panel, which was a giggle. And I was like, you know, the lunatic fringe with Beverly Sills, who was great. She was great. And Ardis Krenick, who ran the Chicago Lyric. And the woman who was running that program was really brilliant. And I came back and I said, gee, there's real money for opera up there. And I started to talk to people and said, you interested in opera? And this brings us up to date. Bob Ashley was already, at this point, already working on Perfect Lives, and Carlotta and I asked him to make an opera for television, because we always felt that we ought to, like you wanted to do radio, we wanted to do television. And so that began. And at the same time, I said to Anthony Davis, "You ever think about writing an opera?" He said, "Oh, I'm writing one." And I said, "What is that?" He said, "Oh, it's about Malcolm X." And so we got like $20,000, I think it was, from the NEA to do a workshop at the kitchen. And you know where it is now. So what I think happened, you know, but meanwhile, I just wanted to say all this, you know, things that were going well. Meanwhile, one of the wonderful things was that some of the best concerts were like, there were like five people in the audience, you know, for Julius Eastman or Arthur Russell or Marianne Amiche, you know. The strangest work was being made and not necessarily getting noticed then or now. So I think I've well gone over my 5 minutes.
A couple of things to comment on what you just said. One of the things that the visual art world shared with us, the New York visual art world, was the opportunity and the stamina to actually sit in a room with only two or three other people and listen, and find that a very respectable way to do it. Because the confusion between watching and looking and listening became an overlay that was symptomatic, that was very useful for performers all over the world who would come to New York looking for that. Okay, David, one more thing. You've got to remember that the 80s, which are sounding like an awful lot of fun right now, came to a crashing, horrible halt. And all the joy that's coming out from the 70s, the revolution, and the feeling that we were powerful, and the nightclubs that went on all night until the next morning, and the sound systems that were set up in all the clubs, we all know where they were, bonds, and all of them, just great sound systems, started being turned off by the time AIDS started striking us, and our whole world and changed into a very different world. And I bring that because it was a bad way to end a great time. And a lot of good work did get made in sadness in addition to joy.
Here. I've invited them to just argue amongst themselves or have a love fest, but either way it goes, we've got a couple, 10 minutes more we can spend on the stage with these four, so light the fuse.
I must admit, when I put the book together, there was a very... I hope the Columbia people are here. They're not here. But when you put a book together through a university press, you get assessed by three or four people, some sort of outsiders who look. in. And of course, what do you think their first comment was? Well, where are the LGBT and the, you know, people of color? And my response was, look at the decade. All the people that were gay, and there are plenty of gay people in the book, Cage, David Diamond, Bill T. Jones, Arthur Russell, there's like five others, they would never say they were gay at that time. It was just not something that you even brought up. So it was an interesting comment, a current comment that didn't relate to the contents of the book. Wasn't really about that. I wasn't trying to make sure everybody was touched. That makes sense.
No, I understand exactly what you mean. It's sometimes when you see, especially nowadays, through a sort of identity politics lens, yeah, then you do have to have representation, this person, that person, one of these, two checked in this box. And one of the things that I remember and that I kind of like about the 80s and downtown was that, yes, I'm not going to deny that I'm black and maybe 90% of the faces around me are not, but I never felt like I was either ignored or put in a special place. I was neither lauded or taken, like, you know, not taken seriously or taken too seriously.
I think New Music during that time didn't really put any things on it because there were a lot of women, there were so many different cultures and people with background that it wasn't really discussed. I don't know. It was just like an open book for everyone.
Well,
I think.
You're talking about the time when hip-hop was mm-hmm. ascendant and not just absorbed and like spat out, but actually integrated and listened to. And downtown in the Bronx became like, you know, you got on the D train and that was...
I think yes. I even tried to think one of the Beastie Boys' early concerts was at the Kitchen, if I recall right. One of the early Beastie Boy concerts was at the Kitchen.
I was just thinking about that. It was, we had Fab Five Freddy, and Fab Four plus one more. The plus one more was a woman who was fabulous. She was amazing, and I don't think it was the first time they'd been downtown. We had, you know.
Well, look at Carlotta Schulman. She was the Goldie Hawn of downtown New York.
We had the break dancers, and there was this one guy called Crazy Legs, who was one of the best dancers I ever saw. And then, you know, what was interesting to me was that I went out on Worcester Street afterwards, and the Paul Taylor dancers were there, and they were trying to do break dancing. And this is 79, right? And so I thought, oh, this is great. And I thought, this is perfect for a documentary because you can just see what's happening. There's, you know, there's things moving. But nobody would give me money to make the documentary. You know, it was one of those things that didn't happen. But you saw that so often, you know. And it was partly because we were all living in a village, you know, everybody lived around the corner, and that rents were cheap then. I mean, they didn't feel like it, but they were. And so I think, you know, the Kitchen was really a very small place. But I think more things happened in the back room of the Kitchen than happened in the actual concert space. You know, like Bill T. Jones and Arnie and, you know, people would be around and they'd start to work with, like, Joe Hannon or with Eric Bogosian and, you know, Julius Eastman would be around and Arthur Russell actually was a music director at the Kitchen at one point. And so there was this kind of easy integration of ideas and... you know, like, let's try it out. It was experiment. The only thing personal I want to say about how I got here was that there's a Noel Coward song. When I was a kid, I grew up in Britain, in Wales, and I lived for the BBC on the radio, that we had the radio. And Noel Coward had a thing on the radio, and he would sing this song called Experiment, which I won't sing, but I used to love to sing it when I was going on the bus to school. It was experiment, though interfering friends may frown, experiment at any attempt to pull you down. If this advice you'll only employ, the future will bring you infinite joy and merriment. Experiment and you'll see. I'm not a big Noel Coward fan, but that was...
Thank you all, you lovely people. Brooke?
How it's really thrilling for me to have all these people here. I really want to celebrate them and celebrate what they've done and their contribution to music. I'm just simply like the archivist here, so I'm nothing in comparison to all these people. So I know that you guys, especially if you read some of the interviews or you know their music now and their backgrounds now, you know how instrumental they are in especially in today's music and what they've contributed to other current and contemporary artists today. So please celebrate them, not me.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thanks to Gaylord and Mary and Alana and Brooke, of course. We have performances by Don Byron, Fast Forward, Shelley Hirsch, and Elliot Sharp to follow. The bar is open. We have a little bit of moving around to do up here, just a couple of minutes. So here we go.